the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
This morning, we kick off by speaking with ocean scientist and journalist Julie Burwald. She talks about the far-reaching consequences of coral reef destruction and the persistence of efforts to keep them alive.
And then world-renowned primatologist Dr. Franz de Waal, who draws on decades of observation and studies of both human and animal behavior, which comes together in his new book, Different: Gender Through the Eyes of a Primatologist.
Julie Burwald received her PhD in ocean science from the University of Southern California. She is the author of Spineless, a very fascinating book about jellyfish. She's also a science textbook writer and editor, and she's written for the New York Times, Nature, National Geographic, and Slate. And she joins us today to discuss her new book, Life on the Rocks: Building a Future for Coral Reefs. It came from a passion for the oceans and a world in peril, especially for coral reefs. And it's also a book about a way forward. Julie Burwald, welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's nice to have you.
Thank you, Lynn. It's great to be here. Hi, John.
Well, tell us a little bit about sort of the genesis of this book. And I think we all have been either scuba or skin diving, where we see portions of coral reef that are dead, and it feels so, I don't know, it just feels so wrong. I don't know if we have this idea that something under the sea should be much healthier than something above ground, but what was your journey with this book?
I had never gone snorkeling till I was in college, and then I was on the study abroad program in Israel, and I was miserable. And so I kind of like saw the sign on a wall for like a marine ecology course. And I was sure, why not? So the next thing I knew, they were handing me a mask and a snorkel and fins, and I stuck my head into the Red Sea. And it was like, this was in the days before tons of documentaries, but like, I couldn't believe what was down there and just how much life and how beautiful and how diverse and how bustling it was. And I thought, I can't believe we live on the same planet as this. And I never knew it. And that, you know, that did change my life. I decided to become a marine biologist. But of course, life doesn't go the way you expect it to go all the time. And I didn't get into grad school to be a coral scientist. I got into grad school to study satellite imagery of the ocean. And, you know, but coral were always kind of that love that I held on to deep in my heart. And then after I became a science writer, I was following the story of the coral and reading about how the heating of the planet was affecting them so greatly. And I just felt like I wanted to write my second book about coral, but I couldn't just write an obituary. I just knew I wouldn't be able to write a whole book like that. But then I went to this meeting in Florida called Reef Futures, and it was a jolt, because all of these coral scientists and all these practitioners, these people who take care of local reefs, were saying, it's not over yet. We have a lot of tools. We have some innovations. We're doing some things that are helping the reefs. And I thought, well, you know, that's the kind of story I could sink my teeth into, you know, without being Pollyanna. Like, I want to say, like, it is an urgent and critical time for the health of the reefs worldwide. But that's not the end of the story. There's more nuance to it than that. And I wanted to help tell those pieces of the story.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that back then there weren't many documentaries, and I believe it debuted at the Sundance Film Festival, the documentary Chasing Coral, which I felt at the end like I just wanted to roll over and get into the fetal position and cry. That film, Chasing Coral, came out in 2017. So now, you know, we're 5 years down the road, and you're talking about it's not an obituary, it's not over, there is some hope. And what gives you the greatest hope?
I mean, so certainly there's like people out there doing cool things. And in fact, one of the stars of Chasing Coral, Richard Beavers, he ends up being a main character in my book as well. Yeah, because he has an interesting point of view about trying to be like the advertising agency for the coral reefs. And I think that the coral reefs tend to fade from our minds so frequently. So what he's trying to do is pretty interesting. But you asked, like, what is the hope? So in terms of people, I mean, there's all kinds of exciting restoration projects. And this is kind of a philosophical shift, because for a long time in the ocean, we talked about conservation, which means just getting out of the way of nature. But this is actively playing a role in restoring coral reefs. And it's happening in different ways around the world, because the reefs are all different all over the world. You know, one of the coolest ones I saw was in Sulawesi, and this one is the Mars Candy Bar Company has created it. And they have, they're the biggest problem right now is blast fishing, which is where locals will fish using explosives, and that causes the reef to turn to rubble. But they have come up with this system called Reef Stars, which are these rebar structures that they network together, and they can plant 100,000 coral in a couple days. They've restored hectares of reef, which is nothing compared to what's out there. But the reefs are beautiful, and it's really working. And so that's a story of hope. In the Caribbean, one of the big problems is that the coral are now so spread out from each other that they're not really reproducing very well. So there's these massive IVF projects where they collect the spawn, make tons and tons of larvae, let those larvae settle down on these kind of tinker toy shaped rock sort of things. And then they can replant hundreds of thousands of coral every year to help boost the populations. So there's things that we're doing that are pretty amazing, but then there's also the things that the coral are doing. That may be the source of some of the greatest hope. The coral themselves are animals like we are, but they depend on this algae that lives in their tissue and photosynthesizes like all plants do, and then feeds the coral about 90% of the sugar that they make. And what bleaching is when the water heats up, the algae leave the coral, taking away their color and leaving them. The coral themselves are clear tissue, but what you see is this white skeleton that they make underneath. So they look like bones. They look like bleached out bones. And when the algae leave, they take not just the color, but they also take the nutrition that they usually feed the coral also. And so the coral start to starve. But what's happening in some places is if the water cools down, the coral can be reinfected with algae again. And in some places, there's a new strain of algae infecting the coral. And that new strain actually can tolerate higher temperatures, like a degree and a half top higher. But there's always a but, right? The algae, those new algae, these more thermotolerant ones, only feed the coral about 60% of the sugar they make. So the coral are kind of trading out business partners for one. It's almost like having a new tenant. It'll pay you a little bit less rent because your air conditioner isn't working, but at least it's paying some rent. So, you know, we don't know what's happening, but it is a form of innovation. And we're just kind of, these are these unfolding stories that are happening.
Well, Julie, I find that fascinating. I mean, there is this relationship between the algae and the coral. When the temperatures do rise, the algae kind of, you know, the relationship breaks up. This whole thing about if the waters were to cool, then the algae moves back in, but the original algae has perished because of the higher temperatures in the first place, or it's the algae's just moved on to do something else?
Yeah, so these algae can live inside the coral, and they like it there because the coral provides a home for them and also supplies them with fertilizer, basically, nitrogen and phosphorus, the things that any plant needs to grow. But the algae, when they leave the coral, they can just swim away into the ocean. They grow a tail, a little flagella, and they just swim off, and they're happy out there in the ocean. Of course, it's a little more dangerous out there because they can get eaten by things. But yeah, they can survive outside of the coral. They don't need the coral. You could say the coral need them more than they need the coral.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I didn't know until I read your book that the collapse of the reefs also shifts people from eating high traditional protein diets to other types of diets that don't have the same nutritional value or protein. And those are mostly people that are in third world nations?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, if you think about, so coral reefs, the kind we're talking about, in tropical waters. And so, you know, those parts of the world, the temperate parts of the world tend to be what we sort of call developed nations. And so, and tropical places tend to be sort of less developed, as you said. And so they do rely on reefs more directly for the primary protein sources. And so as we see reefs collapse, we see people having to shift their diets to less healthy diets. And in fact, I mentioned that Mars restoration, the Mars candy bar restoration in Sulawesi, they have a chocolate factory in Sulawesi, and the people who work in the factory were having to shift from eating fish that they caught on the reef because the reefs weren't as healthy. And that's actually what first inspired them to do that restoration project. They realized that healthy reefs make for a better life for everybody. And so, yeah, I mean, this is what's at stake.
Julie, I had to look up where Sulawesi is.
Yeah.
It's an Indonesian island. It's great to hear that there's a success story there. But going back to the reef stars and the rebar that's sticking up, and then I guess the bigger question is, how do you go about educating a population who has fished in this certain way by using explosives for probably, you know, a couple generations anyway? It's a very efficient, you know, air quotes, way of fishing. I'm sure that you've seen around the world the way of re-educating populations of people to see with the importance of what's going on here for their lifestyles and their diets and their health.
I would almost turn it around a little bit, because one of the really important things that the coral scientists say, who work on reefs say, and you have to work with local populations wherever you are. If you just come in and say, we're going to do this restoration project, but you haven't worked with the people who live there, it's going to fail. And all that money will just be wasted. All that time and effort will just be wasted. So unless the local people are driving the restoration, are intimately involved in it, it really isn't going to be successful. And when we went to see the Mars project, the local people actually had like lobbied Mars to put the restoration around their island, because they were already seeing that the fish populations were coming back due to the restoration project. The Mars team had actually done a previous restoration on a different island. And initially there was buy-in from the local people, but then the administration of the mayor, they got a new mayor basically who wasn't bought into it. And then that restoration failed after that. So it's you can't come in and say like, we're going to restore the coral, you know, like that's never going to work. So, So really it's not about re-education. It's more about like working together with.
Again, with that specific restoration project with the rebar and how you regrow or help the coral to grow, can you explain a little bit about that and how easy it is to do and how prolific the coral is?
Well, the thing about working in Indonesia, so coral reefs are not equal all over the world. There's a center of coral diversity. So that's called the Coral Triangle. And it's in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. It's between Indonesia, Papua New Guinea and the Philippines. It's kind of a triangle shape. It's not exactly a triangle shape, but anyway, something around 400 species of coral live in that part of the world. So you've got like this incredible like source of coral diversity to work with there. So they're working in like the prime real estate location to do a coral restoration. Comparatively, in the Caribbean, there's only about 44 species of coral, so 10 times less. So, you know, what you have to work with in the Caribbean is a lot less. But yeah, in Sulawesi, they basically, there are what are called corals of opportunity. So coral break and fragment off. So they have some of the fishermen go out and collect corals that are broken. And they know which ones will live at the certain depth where they're doing the restoration. They try to include something around 40 or 50 species when they do a restoration so that there's diversity there, so that if for whatever reason one kind of coral is actually not happy, the other ones can sort of take over. There's a little bit of a land grab among the coral that are put into a restoration spot. They kind of network. You tie using zip ties, you tie the coral on, and the fishermen, they pay the fishermen to do this work and use local divers also to do this. And they zip tie the coral onto these rebar structures, and then the rebar structures are moved to the restoration site and networked together and staked in place. And then they've discovered lots of like little details that make things successful. So if you put a restoration near a healthy reef, then the animals from the healthy reef start invading the restored site faster. And in fact, they've even discovered that a healthy reef, just like a healthy forest, has a certain audio environment. So it has like, it's not birds chirping, but the equivalent. So like fish grunting and snail snapping, or sorry, not snails, shrimp snapping, and the sounds of health. And they actually play the sounds of health on the restoration site, and the animals start showing up. They're like, oh, this is a good place to live. And so they start doing the things for the coral, like pruning away the algae that help the algae grow fast. I mean, help the coral grow faster. So they're doing a lot of things to make those restorations successful. And like I said, like after 3 years, these restorations look, you can't even tell it's a restoration. They're so beautiful.
Well, that is just fascinating about the audio clips that are encouraging this process to continue. And I'd like to know, in addition to the climate change going up a couple of degrees or a degree Celsius in our oceans, does the acidification of oceans, does that affect the coral reefs?
So that's a really cool question, an interesting question. So about 10 years ago, the story of acidification kind of got onto scientists' radar. And the ocean had, you know, the acidity had increased about 30% significantly. And at that time, everybody was like, this is going to be terrible for coral reefs. But in the intervening years, we've come to understand that the coral actually are kind of masters at dealing with acidification. And I'm speaking really broadly here because there's so many species of coral and they live in such different environments. But in general, so far, the coral actually control acidic pH really, really well. In fact, in the little bubble where the algae that, you know, the symbiont lives, they actually make that very acidic, because that makes carbon dioxide more available for the algae to photosynthesize. And then around the place where they lay down their skeleton, they actually change the pH of the water around that area too and make it more basic, because that helps calcium carbonate form, helps limestone form more easily. So they're actually manipulating the pH, really in a really sophisticated manner. And they are capable of doing that. So a living coral is, as one scientist told me, they don't care. A living coral just doesn't care. But a dead coral, which is just limestone, does care. And so in places where the reefs have, where the coral are not living anymore and you just have the reef structure, those places are dissolving away at a much higher rate than in the past because the coral isn't there to manipulate the pH. So yeah, so that's kind of the story.
Julie, I was told that for every three breaths that a human being takes, we can thank the oceans for two of them because of the plant life that, of course, is... So we'll get to this myth because there's a carbon capture and there's the photosynthesis, which is giving off oxygen. So it sounds like you have quite a reaction to what I just said. So why don't you go ahead?
Okay, this is one of my best, biggest pet peeves of all time. And so thank you for asking me about it because I want to clarify this.
Okay.
This is a misconception. So here it is. What we are breathing right now is the result of cyanobacteria, which are ancient bacteria that can photosynthesize and put oxygen into the atmosphere. That has accumulated over 3 billion years.
Yes.
So that's the bulk of the oxygen in our atmosphere. Every year, the land and the oceans give off about the same amount of oxygen through photosynthesis, but that amount, and they're about equal, but that amount is minuscule compared
to
the giant reservoir of oxygen that's already been put in our atmosphere. So if the oceans die, which, you know, you hear, we'll still be able to breathe.
Yeah.
There's so much oxygen in the reservoir of our atmosphere already that the exchange, yearly exchange, daily exchange, whatever you want, a century exchange, is nothing. It's minuscule. So that is a big pet peeve of mine. And I see it all the time on websites and in movies. And it's not true.
Well, I'm glad we talked about it.
Me too. I don't get the chance to talk about it very frequently.
Okay,
I just pull my hair out.
I had another question just before we let you go, about a minute left. Obviously, you are so passionate about this. It's palpable, and we can see it in your face on our Zoom call. We can hear it in your voice. You also weave into the story or the journey of your daughter, who is dealing with some mental health issues. In a way, you're drawing parallels between the life of the coral, the life of your daughter. Can you just tell us what that part is about? Because it makes up a really interesting element of this book as well.
I kind of struggled with that. In Spineless, as I was telling the story of the jellyfish, I was also kind of going back to these places I'd been in grad school, and I'd had sort of a bad boyfriend at that time. And so those stories kind of got woven into the book. And so I kind of am used to writing memoir with science and sort of letting them hopefully enhance each other's story. In this book, I really didn't think I was going to do that. I thought I was going to tell the story of the coral and my travels and this, but my daughter got very sick at the beginning of this book with a mental illness, as you said. I didn't think that they connected, but as I started writing more and more about the sickness on the reef, I started seeing these parallels, which too were really important, which is that the coral, as we've talked about, are kind of invisible to us up here on land. And similarly, mental health can be very invisible as well. I mean, if you saw my daughter, you wouldn't know how much she was struggling and how sick she was. But yet both things are so foundational. I mean, we've talked about how important the corals, they're disproportionately important for the health of the oceans. And mental health, I mean, without the foundation of mental health, what it is to be human becomes very, very almost impossible. So the stories wound together, and I ended up kind of writing them together, especially as the COVID crisis hit, that things became more interconnected in timeline. And I sent a little bit of it to my editor and I said, is this the right thing to do? And she just said, I think it's some of your most powerful writing. And so I talked to my daughter about it and she said, yes. She's like, I don't think mental health should have the stigma that it has. The more we talk about it, the better for all of us. And I'm good with you including this in the story in this book. And so that's how it happened. And hopefully it does hopefully they do enhance each other. That's my hope.
It shows the interconnectedness of humans and the coral reef and all of our plight, right?
Yes,
the book is Life on the Rocks, Building a Future for Coral Reefs. Our guest is Julie Burwald. Julie, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
It's been an honor to be here. Thank you so much. This was a great conversation.
Up next, we welcome world-renowned primatologist Dr. Franz de Waal. In his book, Different, Gender Through the Eyes of a Primatologist, he explores how the sex differences in animal and human behavior raise questions that lie at the heart of almost any debate about human gender. He considers whether the behavior of men and women differ naturally or artificially, and whether there are two genders or are there more? Well, we are pleased he can join us to discuss the complexities of gender roles in primate societies and human societies. Dr. de Waal, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. I'm happy to be there.
Well, we're delighted to have you here. And I would start with this. Can you tell us why you wrote this book?
Oh, because there's a deep curiosity in most people about gender and which part of gender is cultural and which part is biological. We usually distinguish, of course, sex is the biological side, and gender, which is more the cultural side, but I don't think they can be easily disconnected. And so people are very curious about it, and they think that the primates offer an answer, because the primates, of course, show also the biological side, but I would argue, as I do in my book, that they also show the cultural side a little bit.
And we're not talking about monkeys. We're talking about the humanoid branch, the apes and humans.
Mm-hmm.
And you have said in the book that bonobos and chimps are the closest to humans. Can you describe the differences? Because some are more female-dominated, and then there's male-dominated.
Yeah, that's the interesting part. We are used to the comparison with chimpanzees, which are our closest relatives, and that's what people always compare us with. And the chimpanzees are quite violent and male-dominated. But we have an equally close relative, which is lesser known, the bonobo, is exactly equally close genetically to us as the chimp. And the bonobos, they have female dominance, and they are much more peaceful. They're more sexual, they have more sexual behavior, and they are a much more peaceful species. Sometimes we call them the hippies because they don't kill each other like chimpanzees sometimes do. And the females are collectively dominant over the males. The females are not individually bigger or stronger. And so as an individual, one female has trouble dominating a male, but collectively the females do so.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Franz de Waal. He's written a new book called Different, Gender Through the Eyes of a Primatologist. And Franz, you've throughout the decades have spent many, many hours with chimps and bonobos. And I'm just wondering, well, I was fascinated in the story about Donna, who is a chimp, and how it seems that Donna followed in this really great quote that I thought in the book really explained it so well. Gender is like a cultural coat that sexes walk around in. And tell us the story about Donna and how that sort of relates to humans.
Well, Donna was special because a chimpanzee that I knew her already when she was very young, like 3 years old, which is really a baby chimp. And at that time already, she liked to play with adult males. She liked to wrestle with adult males, which the young females never do. The males wrestle with young males because they seek them out. But Donna was very eager to wrestle with adult males, and they responded to her. And so already at an early age, we saw that she was a bit different from the rest. And then when she grew up, she grew up and her body is very male-like. Her genitals clearly female, but her hair and her body and the way she walked, and she hung out with males. I cannot ask her what her identity is or what her pronouns are or whatever, but if I could have asked her, she might have said that she feels like a male, because that's how she acted for sure. And so I call her gender non-conforming. And I think it's interesting to point out that that kind of variation between individuals that you also have in human society, you find also in these primates. You find sometimes males who are not very macho-like, who don't play the macho game of trying to become the dominant male. And you find females like Donna who are more masculine in their behavior. And what I find intriguing about the primates is that they have no trouble with that. I've never noticed, for example, Donna was extremely well integrated in the group. I've never noticed that it causes trouble between them.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And so in primates, unlike in humans, when you talk about in humans, gender roles seem to be in large part a cultural product, but in primates, that is not the case. Anyone is just who they are. They could have homosexual or heterosexual tendencies. It's all very non-binary. It's not black and white. Is that right?
Yeah. I would say for gender, that's for sure. And also in humans. Gender runs, I would not divide it in male and female gender, I would divide it in masculine and feminine, and everything in between. And so gender is really more a spectrum. Sex, you know, the biological sex also in humans is mostly binary, not entirely, maybe 98% binary, male and female. And so sex, the biological, but biological sex is also variable. Now, the reason I also speak of gender in the primates and chimps and bonobos is because they have a very slow development. We consider them adults when they're 16 or something. So they learn a lot of things in their lifetime, and they also learn how to behave as a male, how to behave as a female. So just like humans, there's a cultural side to the sex differences that we see. And they pick up behavior. For example, young females imitate the behavior of their mothers, and young males watch adult males and pick up behavior from them. And so there's a lot of self-socialization going on in them as well.
I like that we're talking about binary. And in the world of binary computing program, it's either a one or a zero. It's not one and a half or zero. It's one or zero. And carrying that into the world, a binary world, is yes or no, or black or white, or good or bad. And I think we've learned over time that there's some bad people that have some good qualities, and there's some nice good people that have some pretty bad qualities. It's a mix, but What I'm curious about is what is it about humans that we need to put things in one bucket or the other? Is it our way of being able to explain the world to ourselves easier?
Yeah, we are a symbolic species, and so we like to label things. So you're a man or a woman, or you're black or white, and or you're heterosexual or homosexual. We like to put labels on things and have boxes for them. And unfortunately, we don't tolerate really people who fall between the boxes or who don't want to fit in a box or say, I don't care about the boxes. And so we are intolerant in that regard, even though, you know, I'm a biologist. In biology, we're very used to variability. So there's no two trees of the same species that look alike. Well, they look alike, but they are not exactly similar. And that's true for every individual in every species. There's always variability, enormous variability. And society has trouble with that. Society likes conformity. And that's a conflict that I don't see in the other primates. So that's the funny thing, is that we have individuals like Donna or males who don't want to be macho males, and I never noticed that they are not tolerated by the rest.
Is it because of our intelligence? Because we can think these things through and set up societal norms, and if you're in or you're out, does it have something to do with our intelligence versus...
Well, I think... The labeling comes from our symbolic tendencies, our language tendencies, but the language is not the source of the intolerance, because there are, of course, societies that have a word for a third gender. So you can invent, and I think maybe that's what's going to happen in our society presently. There's so much discussion about gender and sex that at some point we're going to change our terminology. And maybe we will invent words for people who don't exactly fit in these boxes.
Hmm. I love the quote in your book, gender roles may be cultural products, but gender identity itself seems to arise from within. And you talk about this in your chapter on gender, and certainly we know now, depending on who we are as humans, we know that being transgender is a thing that cannot be helped, that, you, as you say, rises from within. And yet throughout the ages, we have fought it by these cultural and societal norms. It leads into this whole notion of gender, and I was fascinated about the origin of that word gender. Can you tell us?
Yeah, the origin of the word is, it was invented by John Money, a sexologist, who also was the first founder of a gender clinic in the 1950s. And he noticed that there are people who are born with one biological sex, but don't identify as that sex and want to be something else. And they consider themselves to be something else. And he wanted to help these people. And so We had all sorts of insulting words for these people, and he decided that we needed some better terminology. And so he took the word gender from grammar, the gender like a king and a queen, that's gender terminology. He took the word gender from grammar and said, we're going to apply that to these people, and we're going to say that there are genders, and that's more cultural. Gender is more cultural and language-based than sex. And so that's where the term comes from, and it was intended, and I think it worked to open up the discussion about what people are and how they live and so on.
Mm. Franz, as you researched this book and put the book together, what most surprised you about this particular subject?
I was actually most surprised by how little we know about the other primates, and especially the gender diversity, the gender variability that we have, because I thought we would know more. In my own life, you know, I've seen so many primates and I've worked with so many primates that I've seen many examples of individuals who don't exactly fit the mold, who don't exactly fit the male typical behavior or the female typical behavior. And so I knew that from my own experience. But then when I started to look up what we know officially in studies, there's actually very little. And I think that is because there's a certain shyness about sex and gender. People prefer to talk about, let's say, violence and territoriality and things like that. So that's one thing. And also, it's like a bit like in society, we have suppressed that kind of things. We have tried to simplify things, like there's males and females, and that's all there is. We've tried to simplify things in society, and it's incorrect. And maybe as biologists, we've also tried to simplify things.
Jane Goodall spent some time in the wild working with these spectacular animals. Did she start to discover some of the things that you are writing about way back then?
She discovered some of the aggressive behavior of chimpanzees, for sure. And how males and females differ in that regard. So she clearly had an inkling of that. She never worked with bonobos, though. And so that whole dimension of that we have another very close relative who behaves so differently, shows a lot more sexual behavior, shows female dominance. That part was missing at the time.
Hmm. Franz, I'm wondering, as I was reading your book, and I think I even read a few lines that you said this yourself, the complexity of this really has it us all kind of confused. It's very confusing, and I have to say to myself these words over and over, gender identity, it's how you identify, and then sexual mm-hmm. preference, it's a completely different concept, in some ways not even related to gender identity. And I'm wondering if you took If you took sort of how we define things in our language, our human language, and applied those in your study of primates.
Yeah, you know, with gender identity, we're going through the same sort of discussion as we've done with sexual orientation. So there was a time 10 years, 15 years ago, where people would have conversion therapies for homosexuals, for gays and lesbians. They thought they could change things, and now I think we accept for sexual orientation, we accept generally in society, that's just how someone is, you're not going to change this. And I think with gender identity, we are reaching that same point. Is we have a group of people who want to change things and want to talk children out of this and want to influence them and say conversion therapies and so on. And I think we're going to reach the same point that it is inherent, that it is you're born with that tendency. And also, I would say the gender identity of what we call cisgender people, the gender identity of most men and women, is also something you're born with. And so it's inherent to what you are, and you're not going to change it easily.
Right. I have a friend who had a young son who loved to dress up with, he would, you know, easily don the tutus and the fairy dresses that his female little friends, you know, they loved to dress up with him. And he loved this pair of pink patent leather shoes. And his mother was very open-minded and embraced it. And that boy grew up and he is very male at this point, you know, that is his gender identity, is very male. And I think that what I'm reading in, and I know this about gender identity study or, you know, departments at universities and clinics and things like that, is that you let, it's kind of how the primates act, where you just let them flow along with their own intrinsic gender identity. And then at some point, they decide who they are versus trying to squelch it and hope that they just fit in somewhere. You're going to be who you're going to be. And I thought that that was a really interesting part of your study of primates.
Yeah, all these things take time. So for example, Donna, the chimpanzee, she never changed her tune, so to speak. She was male-like in the beginning, she was male-like in the end. But all these things take time, and you have to, and I'm of course not an educator, I'm not a psychologist for children, but I think in their case too, you take your time. There's really no hurry to decide in 2 weeks what you want to be. And so in the primates, I see individuals who have these tendencies, but typically they arise early in life and they don't change very much.
Boy, I think about humans have been around somewhere between 2 and 6 million years, and we can learn so much from these other animals that have been around for so much longer. And we recently spoke to Brian Scarry, who along with James Cameron put together this series for National Geographic called The Secrets of Whales. And when they were covering the orcas down in New Zealand and up by the Arctic Circle, two completely different pods of orcas, the grandmother was the matriarch of the family, and she set the rules. She did all the teaching how to ride a wave, how to turn your dorsal fin so the seal doesn't see it, how to grab the seal and back up in time before you get caught because of the wave, all these different things, and was in charge of getting the food and then sharing the food. And orcas have been around forever, and we can learn so much from these other animals, and hopefully we're going to study them more. I mean, you know, orcas have been around for over 50 million years.
Yeah, so it's interesting that you mentioned that this female was the leader. So that's another thing is that I discuss in my book, is that female leadership. So even in species where the males physically dominate the females, like let's say it's a chimpanzee or baboons or species like that, even in those species, you have a female hierarchy and you have an alpha female. So you have a female who's boss over the other females and is the leader of them. And female leadership is very easy to find in the animal kingdom. You know, all the females have hierarchies. They worry more about where they are in the female hierarchy than their relation with males, really. And the males have their own hierarchy. And so people always think in terms of the alpha male, he decides everything. No, the alpha female can be extremely important, even in these societies where the males are physically dominant. And that's why in my book I make a distinction between dominance and power. Yes, you may have in chimpanzees the alpha male, but maybe the alpha female. I knew an alpha female who was basically the one who decided which male was going to be alpha, because a male could not reach the top without her support. And so female leadership is easy to find in the animal kingdom, and that whole story that people sometimes tell is that males are naturally the leaders. That doesn't sit well with the primatologist that I am.
No, it doesn't sit well. And I think people, Lynn, do you think people are starting to open up to this? I mean,
I certainly hope so.
Yeah.
I think people are. I've learned a lot about it. John and I have a transgender friend, and I think for both of us, we have learned a lot about it, and it's been very welcome to learn, because we're both very cisgender and binary.
And it's been... It's been a great experience for all of us, yeah, that know her. Yeah. I'm working on my pronouns, Franz. It's not easy.
Well, it is confusing, the picture, and I'm not necessarily simplifying it in my book, because I'm adding the cultural layer in the primates also, and I'm adding these two species that are close to us who are so different in their behavior. And so I'm not simplifying things. I think people like simple things, like male, female, and that's the sort of the distinction they want. But that's not how nature works, really.
Yeah. My brother grew up with three sisters, and my brother is very sensitive and very touchy-feely and very emotional, and he really understands women. And my question is, you know, would he have been that way had he grown up in a family with three brothers? And you, Franz, grew up, unfortunately for your parents, they never had any girls, but they had six boys. And I'm curious about the spectrum there.
Yeah, I'm from a family of six boys. And I also went to boys' schools. And so it's only at the college level that I started to meet a lot of girls. And so my curiosity about gender maybe comes from that, in the sense that I didn't have a lot of experience with the other gender. And I joined at some point a women's rights movement when I was a college student, and was maybe also out of curiosity at the time, because I certainly don't agree with the inequality that exists in society. But I didn't have any direct experience with that, because I grew up in a male world, really.
Right. And you go into this in your book as well, talking about the injustices of sexism, really. And you see it in the primate world that women can be strong and leaders and dominate, you know, can dominate and all of that. And so it must leave some big questions in your head about how we still seem to be stuck in some ways, though we're moving out of it, of those gender norms.
At the moment I have to think about it, because everyone always says that men are privileged. At the moment, with the Ukraine war, I see all of a sudden that men, you know, and boys, they have what kind of trouble we have. I escaped it. I'm from after World War II, and so I never was in a war or in a war zone. But as soon as wars erupt, then men are called up to arms and have to fight and are going to get killed. And so that's the one moment in the world where men are not privileged. Men have to fight. And that's what's happening at the moment in Ukraine, is that the women and children escape the country, millions of them, and the men have to stay back and defend their country.
Well, you are a New York Times bestselling author of Mama's Last Hug. This new book, Different, Gender Through the Eyes of a Primatologist, is getting a lot of buzz. I suspect that's going to be very successful. What are you working on next, Franz?
Oh, I'm not ready yet to think about a following topic. I wrote this book during the pandemic when I was 18 months locked up at home, couldn't go anywhere. And so this was a good time to write the book. And at the moment, I'm not thinking about the next topic, but I'm sure there's one that's coming.
Franz, I have just one burning question remaining. You know, you talked about chimps being dominant and violent, the males being dominant and violent, the bonobos. The culture is run by females. It's more peaceful. I'm imagining that you, well, or did you also find females that showed violence and aggression among bonobos?
Yeah, females. People often think that the alpha female in bonobos must be nice and females must be nice to each other. I don't agree with that. Is that females can be very nasty. They're not as physically violent as the males. And so the killing of other individuals, that's more a male thing. That females do that less. But it's not as if it's a very nice, relaxed type of hierarchy that you see in the bonobos, because the alpha female, she needs to assert her position on occasion. And if younger females or males don't act the way she wants them to act, she's going to punish them. And so that's an illusion that people have always, is that women and females are relaxed and loving with each other. That's not necessarily the case. And also in humans, of course, mm-hmm. we know that now, is that we sometimes assume that, but we know now that if women are together, there's also some nastiness going on.
Oh, yes. Well, the book is Different: Gender Through the Eyes of a Primatologist. Our guest is Franz de Waal, a renowned primatologist, and we're so happy you could join us today on Cool Science Radio. I'm headed out for a road trip with my mom next week. I'd love to listen to this. Is this on
audio? There's an audio book.
Okay.
Yeah, there's an audio book. Yeah.
Oh, wonderful. Thanks, Franz. We appreciate this conversation.
Thank you. Yeah, welcome.
Bye-bye. Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you want to share it, all our shows are under the Shows tab. We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows. Wherever you find your podcasts, you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name. So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. And hey, tune in next week.